Hello, this is episode number 38 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Wednesday, December 18th, 2008. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Several of our previous podcasts, we've discussed what we called the Comcast kerfuffle, which was the controversy surrounding the steps Comcast took to manage BitTorrent traffic on its networks. Critics called it a violation of net neutrality principles, while Comcast and others called it sensible network management. This week we saw a new kerfuffle of sorts develop over the revelation in a front-page Wall Street Journal story on Monday that Google had approached some major cable and phone companies and supposedly proposed to create its own fast lane for online content. What exactly is Google proposing? What does it all mean? And is the Wall Street Journal correct, as some have suggested, that Google is somehow now going back on their support for net neutrality principles and regulation? More importantly, what does it all mean for the future of the Internet, network management, and consumers? That's what we'll be discussing on today's show. Joining me for today's discussion are some of our regular contributors at the TLF who both wrote about this issue multiple times this week. We're joined by Cord Bloomquist of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hi, Cord.
Hello, Adam.
Brett Swanson of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Adam.
And we're joined by two more additional guests with some technical networking experience in their background. We're pleased to be joined again on the podcast by Richard Bennett, a computer scientist and network engineering guru who blogs at Broadband Politics as well as Circle ID, and he also pens occasional columns for the Register. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Adam.
And we're also joined by my colleague Adam Marcus, who's a research fellow and senior technologist at Progress and Freedom Foundation, who wrote about this issue in his occasional Nuts and Bolts column this week on the Progress and Freedom Foundation blog. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Adam.
Richard Bennett, let's begin with you. Why don't you lay out what your take is on this Wall Street Journal article and the developments that we've been debating this week and that you've been writing about?
Okay. What the story says in general terms is that Google is negotiating with ISPs to locate servers inside ISP networks that are essentially directly connected to the last mile system and bypass the public internet for certain Google content, unspecified Google content. There were some additional claims that Google in general is backing away from their support for network neutrality, and Larry Lessig, who is, while not a Google employee, is often identified as someone who advocates for Google's interests, has modified his views on network neutrality. There were sharp denials from Lessig over the claim that he had changed his position on one particular aspect of the network neutrality regulatory framework that he's proposed in the past. And, of course, Google denied that their support for network neutrality is anything less than enthusiastic.
So was there a change substantively, would you say, in the way Google is approaching things with what they're talking about doing with their new edge-catching systems?
I don't think the edge caching system is really anything that's all that earth-shattering for Google. They already have invested several billion dollars on the order of, say, $4 or $5 billion in a private network of server farms around the world. I mean, this is just where they probably, people estimate 2 million CPUs are housed in these data centers around the world, and they're connected to public internet exchange points through some very high-speed data links. What they've done is they've moved they're starting to negotiate to move their content even a step closer to consumers, which is going to be a great boon for some of their apps like YouTube, because they'll be able to stream video with much less congestion and with higher quality of service than they can do from their existing network of server farms. I've written before that Google's support for network neutrality in this most recent phase that focused on Comcast was much less enthusiastic than it was in 2006 when the issue was ironically fast lanes. I think that one of the things that we learned from this controversy is that network neutrality remains a concept which is many different things to many different people.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point, because that's something we've debated quite a bit on the Tech Liberation Front blog is, you know, what is it that the critics, or in this case, the supporters of net neutrality mean by the term? And this might be a good point to bring in Cord Bloomquist, because Cord, you've talked about this in some of your essays, and you wrote about this specific Google kerfuffle, if you will, this week in two different essays on the TLF. Tell us your take on this.
Well, my take is that net neutrality means so many things to so many different people. It's really hard to tell if Google is violating net neutrality. I'm sure to some, placing these sorts of servers on ISPs is something that that does seem like it's anti-neutrality. Some people do seem upset about it on the web. But according to Google, net neutrality isn't about short lanes, as some people are calling this, putting data closer to end users. It's about fast lanes, the kind of things that Limelight and other content delivery networks do, building their own fast pipes to places like a central hub at Comcast or a central hub at Verizon or something like that. So what does this really mean for net neutrality? I don't know. I don't even know what net neutrality means anymore.
Well, Brett Swanson, let me bring you into this, because you've suggested that there may be something to this Wall Street Journal story, and that maybe there is a more important shift underway in the neutrality debate and in Google's own thinking on the issue. Why don't you fill us in on what you said in your piece on the Tech Liberation Front this week?
Sure, thanks. Well, I mean, I was taking the Wall Street Journal's story at face value when they said that, basically asserted without direct quotes that Google was softening its policy position. And my view was that the realization of Google's, build out of their edge caches, as well as the global network of Googleplexes that Richard mentioned, and I think his numbers were probably even conservative. They're spending $2 or $3 billion per year on CapEx now. My view is that it just exposed some of the shortcomings of any net neutrality proposal, that it all attempted to itself be a neutral policy proposal, and that it treated in the sense that a law should treat everybody equally. So I don't know the facts about what Google internally, what their real position on this is now. But from my perspective, merely a better public understanding of how the net works, about routing and switching and the core of the network and the edge of the network and caching at the edge of the network and so forth, will help people understand why a net neutrality law, even if attractive in theory, would be so difficult to define and implement.
That's a good point. Let me ask you to stop there so I can bring in Adam Marcus and get him involved in the conversation, because he wrote about that specific point in his piece this week on the PFF blog about net neutrality and edge caching. And in one section of that essay, Adam Marcus, you talked about what edge caching was and what it wasn't and its relationship to net neutrality. Do you want to maybe provide some more details about that and help explain to us and the listeners what that's all about?
Sure. One of the analogies I made in that piece was to the telephone system's toll-free numbers. When telephone operators were seen as common carriers, they were still allowed to offer toll-free numbers, which meant that if someone was willing to pay more for a toll-free number, it would be easier for people to access them because they didn't have to pay the long-distance charges. And no one had a problem with that. That wasn't seen as an uneven playing field. But Google spending some money to make it easier or faster for people to access their content, in this regard, where it's not decreasing speeds for anyone else. In fact, as Brett pointed out in his piece, it could increase speeds by decreasing the bandwidth going over the long lines. This is seen as uneven.
So, but that's not, you're not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, what exactly does that mean for your average consumer or for other types of application providers?
Well, for the average consumer, I don't think they'll ever notice the minor differences that net neutrality advocates or opponents are arguing over.
Mm-hmm. Richard Bennett, do you want to build on that at all?
Well, I think there is cause for concern among network neutrality advocates, over this system, and it really is in conflict with the program that's been pushed by free press and save the internet and what I'd call essentially the mainstream of the network neutrality regulatory movement. Because although this system does, well, in the first place, it's not any different from a technical standpoint than what Akamai does with their content delivery network. So Google's not breaking any new technical ground here. But it represents an enormous barrier to entry to anyone who wants to compete with Google in video streaming or even in internet search, because it's simply another example of their using their enormous financial resources to erect barriers to entry in the markets that they dominate. And I'm not saying personally that that's a bad thing, but just if there were a network neutrality advocate on the call here, I think that's the argument that they would bring up.
Well, let's develop that a little bit, because you mentioned Akamai and we've talked about on the blog what Akamai and Limelight Networks and other sort of bit managers do in this regard, and saying, okay, Google's just getting in this business. But I've heard some pushback from others, including some in the net neutrality field, saying, well, there might actually be a concern here, because unlike an Akamai or a Limelight, who actually own none of the bits that are going across their networks, Google mm-hmm. now does own bits and is a player in this field. If nothing else, it's got YouTube, and it's got a lot of other content that it's fundamentally got tied up a lot of value in. So is that a potential concern or a violation of net neutrality? I'll go first back to Richard Bennett, and then I'll get Cord and Brett back in here.
If you buy the structural separation model of net neutrality that's been promoted by Susan Crawford, who's a member of the Obama transition team overseeing the FCC, among others, it would be a problem, because you have essentially content and transport bundled together into one commercial entity who uses their influence and control over a very significant portion of the internet's infrastructure to privilege their content, which was kind of the original complaint that when network neutrality became a legislative issue in 2006, this was the original complaint that advocates were focusing on at that time.
Mm-hmm. Good. Cord, can I get you to comment on that question as well?
Well, one thing that's interesting is someone pointed out in the comments on TLF that Google might actually be reselling a lot of the capacity it puts into these servers. So it may not only be Google bringing an Akamai or Limelight-like service in-house or handling it themselves, they may be reselling a lot of capacity to other people too. So to me, it seems like this benefits people at every level of ability to pay for bandwidth or pay for store width, as we've been calling it on the blog too. It frees up the internet's core of all this traffic. It offers this caching service to others, and it certainly helps Google, the titan of the internet, out by building out this big structure. So I don't see where the harm is.
Brett, you want to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, in a way, it's rebuilding something of what, you know, the cable networks, their architecture from, say, 30 years ago, where, you know, they received, content was broadcast from satellites up above to the head ends of cable TV networks and then streamed from a closer point to their end user customers. And the places where content is stored and where it's streamed from is constantly shifting on all these networks depending on the economics of the technologies and, you know, how much bandwidth costs, how much storage costs, how much what the latency requirements are for the latest content technology, whether it's just email or whether it's now, you know, high-resolution video conferencing, which obviously can't be cached, or whether it is cacheable content like YouTube. So you've got this very dynamic interplay among the storage, bandwidth, switching technologies, and this has been one of the very key arguments that those of us skeptical of net neutrality have always made, is that this is not a static arena. This is a very dynamic arena where some of the fastest moving technologies on the face of the earth are. And so you've got to allow this experimentation and investment, which, keeps shifting, the bottlenecks and eliminating bottlenecks, but then, of course, new ones pop up. And if I can just go on one more minute here,
sure.
Just to give some historical perspective, back in 2001, George Gilder hosted what we called then the first StoreWidth conference, which was dedicated to these issues of content delivery networks and where the big new data centers around the world would be built. And we had these, it's funny now, but you know, we had these existential, very vigorous, almost religious debates between Akamai and another company at the time called Mirror Image. You know, Akamai at the time had something like 10,000 content storage points, and this other company, Mirror Image, was building 32 caps, content access points they were called. And the, you know, the big debate was over whether you had enough bandwidth so that these 32 content access points were basically enough content points around the globe. And if you have enough bandwidth and you have enough points, you can reduce latency. And the critique of Akamai was that if you get too many content storage points, you cannot keep your content up to date, and so forth. And so it's a very technical debate over these things. But I just give that background to say that we've been, you know, this is not a new issue, as Richard says. It came up in the Wall Street Journal this week, and a lot of people thought it was a new issue, but in fact, this is a very, very old, very technical topic that goes right to the heart of how the internet has always worked, certainly for the last 15 years. And so, you know, in fact, as Richard has pointed out many times, the internet has never been strictly neutral, whether you're talking about quality of service, prioritizing packets, or putting packets closer to their endpoint. We've always done things to increase performance.
Let me ask Adam Marcus to jump back in the conversation, and you should feel free to comment on what Brett just said. But also, I want to ask you about, you know, exactly why is it that Google is doing this now at this point with this new system it's calling apparently Open Edge? And what is the advantage for Google doing it right now in terms of what they can cache and with this new system that they couldn't before or they couldn't rely on other systems for?
Sure. The first thing people should realize is Google has not stated explicitly, as far as I can tell, what they're going to use this for. Google did purchase YouTube, and YouTube did use an edge caching system for its videos. The most likely use for Google is to do the same thing, to cache the YouTube videos. And as Brett was sort of explaining, this type of system really only works for content that doesn't change that often. So I don't see how Google could use this to increase the speed of its search system. I don't see how it could be used for anything interactive. The most likely use is caching the YouTube videos. Maybe they'll use it to cache some of the banner ads that they serve up through the ad network, although that is mostly keywords. So I'm not even sure if there'd be much use for it there. I think Google is a smart company, and they said, you know, we can use this now for our YouTube videos, and we'll probably find some other uses in the future, and that's why they decided to set up the system themselves versus contract it out.
Interesting. Let me open a new front here, because there was an interesting column by two columns, actually, on Circle ID by David Eisenberg, who's a well-known net neutrality supporter and network engineering guru. And Richard, I know you've debated with David on these issues in the past. Mm-hmm. You have too. But Eisenberg wrote a column at first after the Monday Wall Street Journal article appeared, saying, "Oh, there's nothing here to see. That's not really a big deal. Google's not doing anything all that different than what other caching companies do or anything else." But then he wrote an interesting follow-up piece saying, "You know, what if I was wrong about this? Maybe there's something more to it." In which he had an interesting quote, and actually let me read you a line from it. He says, "What if Google were attempting to put a server, say, in a head end or a central office in such a way that it faced the local customers connected to that head end or central office? In this case, Google would be in a very privileged position," he says. "It would be communicating with the cable co or telco's customers not via the internet but via a single wire, the last mile wire. And then he goes on to talk about, and this is what I found most interesting about it, about the question of if this so-called privileged position for Google and this co-location of its devices on telco or cable premises starts to reopen what we thought was a closed chapter of communications law having to do with co-location regulations from the mid-90s. And, of course, there is, unfortunately, a rich body of literature and law that have been written around the question of physical co-location of devices within the facilities of a telecommunications company, which was at the heart of the sort of Telric and UNIP wars in telecom policy throughout the 90s. So I hope I'm not getting off on too much of a tangent here, but I thought this was very interesting because Eisenberg seems to be saying that maybe now there is something to this story because, you know, Google is getting sort of a privileged position, you know, up at headquarters, if you will, or in the head end of some sort, and that maybe we need to consider giving others that same sort of position, or maybe we've got to get back into the co-location issues. Richard Benham, am I reading too much into this, or is that where we may be going next on this?
No, I think that's exactly where we're going. I exchanged some email with Rick Witt, Google's head lobbyist on this question last week, and apparently was one of the few people who wrote about it in the press that got a direct quote. And his argument in favor of this system is that he thinks it's permissible under Title II regulations, and which, of course, we know the FCC has said Title II regulations don't apply to Internet service providers, but in the way that Rick would like to see Internet service providers regulated, which is much more strictly than Internet service companies like Google, this would be they'd have to open up space in their central offices for anyone that wants to install this kind of a system.
And what's interesting about this is that a little bit of background on Rick Witt. Rick's a really a good guy. I've known him for many, many years, but we've locked horns on quite a few of these issues, these regulatory issues. And throughout the 90s and early 2000s, Rick worked for MCI WorldCom and was advocating prior to their merger with Verizon and their bankruptcy that he was advocating basically these sorts of regulations in the telco world. And so in some ways you start to see how, you know, some bad ideas never really die. They just come back in another form. And here we have a person who was really an architect of some of those rules, maybe suggesting we just apply them in a different way for a different layer of the net. Brett Swanson, you were involved in these battles as well going way back. Do you think there's anything to that kind of a line of reasoning?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I remember along with you, Adam, when we first were seeing back in this 2004 time period, some of the old debates of the 90s were starting to come to a close, and we started to see these new ideas percolate, particularly under the MCI network layers proposal, which is sort of, as you suggest, was sort of the basis of network neutrality as we now know it. And it was fairly ill-defined to me back then. Yeah, exactly. And as it is today. But, you know, just to the point of, you know, these edge caching or content delivery systems, it exposes a, you know, real, you might say, hypocrisy or a double standard to say that we should be able to improve performance through putting content in the optimal place. And I think they absolutely should. And as Adam Marcus was saying, for static content, but for dynamic interactive content, which will of course also be a very big part of the web, whether it's voice over IP or video conferencing or 3D video gaming, etc., which is not going to be able to use these edge caching or content delivery networks, but will require very smart prioritization and QoS in real-time fiber speed, you know, 10 gigabit or 40 gigabit or 100 gigabit routing and switching, you know, to say that we cannot use the smartest technologies in the interactive realm seems to be the big double standard that I'm trying to point out.
Cord Bloomquist, let me ask you, you've written quite a bit about Google's run-ins with others in Washington on many other fronts, whether it's advertising, the search market, the antitrust allegations of market power. Do you think this just leads into fuels the fire, if you will, of those efforts by some to try to make Google out to be sort of a nefarious monopolist that needs to be investigated, if not brought under the thumb of regulation?
Oh, yeah, I think we've already seen something on this on the Precursor blog, haven't we? The usual Google haters are going to hate Google even more because of this. But I don't think there's really any reason to. I think some of this really boils down to people being mad that it's easier for big companies to do things. But I mean, this seems to me as silly a thing to protest as why should Walmart have its own distribution network? They should route everything through FedEx. Well, that's an absurd argument. At a certain level, companies reach a very large size, so they don't have to go through someone like Akamai or Limelight. They build their own thing. And, this is just another example of that, and why we object to it and throw our hands in the air when it's on the net, but we think it's perfectly natural when it's out in the, brick-and-mortar physical world, I don't know.
But to play devil's advocate.
I know the answer to that.
Go ahead, Richard.
Well, remember the arguments that Google was making in 2006 for network neutrality regulations, where they said they weren't really out to protect their own interests. They were looking out for the next Google. They wanted to create this perfect competitive environment where the next Google or the next Yahoo could start up in a dorm room or a garage and come into the internet and do combat with Google. But now you see, Google using their enormous financial resources to erect barriers to entry against the next Google. So what are they really advocating for? Are they really trying to keep the internet open and free? Or are they just trying to create a regulatory environment in which they can achieve market power and prevent competitors from coming up against them?
And basically what you're saying, Richard, is that the ability of Google has the ability because of their financial might to strike this sort of a deal to either somehow partner with a cable or telco or even collate devices within their head ends to be basically delivering their bits faster or more efficiently than someone else's, and that sort of leads to a natural aggregation of even more money, power, whatever else, viewers to their services. Court or Brett or Adam Marcus, anyone care to respond to that sort of an allegation?
Well, I don't see how any garage-based company is going to compete with someone like Google. I mean, Google had to grow from a garage-based at least not initially. You can't come out of the gates from a garage and say, I'm going to compete with a company that's taken a decade to get where it is. Google took a long time to grow up, had an IPO, had an influx of cash, before they could really stand toe-to-toe with someone like Yahoo. So, these types of technologies are available to companies, to other companies, edge caching and so on. And one would assume that any company that tries to compete with Google in the future to be the next Google, as Google says, would have to seek incredible outside resources to do so. And, I think we should have these types of technologies available for them. They can buy their own edge caching. Google 2 can do that as well as Google the original.
So on that point, just really quickly, go ahead, Brett, you have a comment?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, Google started as a search engine company. They had the best, fastest algorithm to deliver good results, and that's what, launched them initially. But, at least 5 years ago, they started becoming more of a internet infrastructure company, and now their key advantage is not necessarily their algorithms, but their large, very capable platform, which they're investing billions and billions and billions of dollars in. It's a huge, important part of the internet. And so I think Google absolutely, should be able to and encouraged to do what they're doing and make the internet faster and more robust and deliver, the world's information, as they like to say, to us all, but it does again expose the double standard in their original net neutrality argument, which was that the cable and telecom companies had too much market power in their last mile links, I would argue that nobody has a internet platform like Google has at the center of the network, where there's actually maybe now more competition at the edge in the last mile than there is in the Google platform.
So really quickly, one thing I was going to follow up with and ask Adam Marcus to comment on is that, you know, forget about the garage-based competitors. Like Cort said, that's going to take them years to scale up to get anywhere near big enough to compete with the big dogs like Google and company. But let's talk about the big dogs. Adam Marcus, you already mentioned Yahoo and the way they've done some of this in the past. But what about Microsoft? I mean, we've looked into this. I know one of the things I've noticed many years ago is that Microsoft started cutting deals with Limelight and others to deliver higher speed throughput for their online gaming systems through Xbox Live networks for their 360. And why aren't they doing what Google's doing? Are they somehow, I mean, they have pretty deep pockets, right? I mean, is this something that it's just a matter of them getting around to using that same sort of business model? Are we going to have a Google server, a Microsoft server, a Yahoo server, and several others all co-located at certain access points? Or how does this play out in the future, Adam Marcus?
Well, let's see. A lot of stuff there. Something that I don't think we've mentioned explicitly is cloud computing. Another possible perceived use that Google had in its decision to set up its own edge servers is the next step in internet computing, which is cloud computing, where it's hosting other people's content. Microsoft is, I think one of their new taglines is software as a service. When we're talking about the next Google and other competitors, it used to be they needed to buy a lot of hardware, they needed to install the hardware. Nowadays, the hardware requirements are less important, but there's still software and staffing requirements. And as cloud computing gets more and more prevalent, the cost to compete with someone like Google is going to be getting enough upfront investors to simply set up a system using all off-the-shelf and really out-of-the-cloud resources, whether it's disk space or bandwidth or processing power, which are, you know, the three ingredients to any new internet startup. You could purchase it all in the cloud, so you just need enough resources at first to build an audience and set up a system that has a feedback loop where the bigger your audience gets, the more successful it is. I think Microsoft is working on this. They have their own cloud computing initiative, which will involve its own data warehouses. Whether the warehouses are stored in centralized facilities or at local ISPs, I think is something that they'll balance as they figure out the trade-offs between the cost of bandwidth and the cost of co-locating their equipment.
And Richard Bennett,
and just
go ahead, Brett.
Oh, just to add quickly, Microsoft announced about a week or 10 days ago that they plan to build 20 additional data centers at the cost of about $1 billion apiece, so $20 billion for this new cloud computing initiative.
Right. So, Richard Bennett, I'm going to give you the chance to have a last word here, commenting either on what Brett or Adam Marcus said, or just maybe a look forward about what happens next and how this plays into the net neutrality debate.
Yeah, I think the aspect of this story, which I would like to see the Wall Street Journal cover in the follow-up, is what the implications are for this system from the standpoint of Google investors. I think the part that I find intriguing then is that after spending all these billions of dollars building large-scale data centers, has Google now discovered that that was a mistake, and where they really should be spending their infrastructure dollars is closer to the end user by installing these systems inside ISPs? Because it really is a different approach than what they've been pursuing up until now, and apparently they're mega data center strategy, you know, hasn't worked out that well, because when they did their recent YouTube Live concert, they had to actually contract with Akamai to collaborate in the delivery of that content.
Right, right. That's a good point. Well, thank you, Richard, and thank all of you. That's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Richard, Adam Marcus, Brett, and Cord for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. If you'd like to leave a comment about something we said here today, you can do it on the show's website, which is at techliberation.com/podcast. And you can also dig our podcast and download it on iTunes. So until next time, we'll see you. I'm Adam Thayer.